Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, May 4th. That's right. It's Star Wars Day. More on that a little bit later. I hope you're having a great day so far, and you're trusting in the mercies and the graces of God, which are new every day, living and promised to us in a mystery beyond our understanding, really. God with us, carrying us, surrounding us with his saints and their prayers, and particularly the Blessed Mother here in this month of Mary, the month of May. I'm looking forward to my guest next hour, Andrew Flowers. Andrew, who writes with one of my favorite websites, 538.com. They cover a whole host of different topics, and they look at things really through a data and statistical lens. What I really like about 538.com is that it really takes up arguments and considers them on their own merits, not simply on our predisposed view of them or our caricatures and so forth. And they cover, of course, a whole wide range of topics. And one topic that they cover is the issue of economics. And Andrew Flowers, who actually was on the program, I think it was last fall, talking about sports, we were looking at the college football playoff, which was sort of starting to come into shape. But he has an interesting article that caught my attention from about a week ago. What would happen if we just gave people money? He talks about this concept of universal basic income. Basically, the government of a particular nation guaranteeing an unconditional income to its citizens. It's one of those ideas that, you know, for somebody like me who tends to be fairly conservative, I mean, back in the day, I was a subscriber. It was a gift subscription, but nonetheless, a subscriber to the Limbaugh Letter, probably about 25 years ago. So I hear something like, you know, what would happen if we just gave people money? It sets off all sorts of red flags, you know, like in my best Carl Spackler, you know, check me if I'm wrong, Sandy, but if we just gave people money, what incentive would they have to do anything? Well, Andrew Flowers takes on all those sort of objections to the idea of some sort of a universal basic income, something that in this concept, which, by the way, he didn't come up with, it's actually been around for quite some time, but seems to be gaining a little bit of steam as our economy changes, as we're seeing more and more automation come in and eliminate unneeded jobs, for example, or human capital or labor, and how this tremendous shift is really going to create a crisis of sorts, and that we have this unwieldy bureaucracy when it comes to a social safety net. All these various acronyms, you know, that that we have out there for all of these different things that are so complicated in determining who can qualify for it. You know, we've got also this whole situation, almost a disincentive to people that if they reach a certain income, they can no longer be eligible for certain aid. By the way, here's the alphabet soup of programs, right, in this patchwork benefit system we have, like SNAP, CHIP, Section 8, EITC, WIC, you go down the list. The U.S. government spends nearly $1 trillion across dozens of separate programs at the state and federal level. So that's something else that universal basic income would do, would eliminate a lot of that bureaucratic nightmare. So what I want to encourage us to do, and Andrew Flowers will be on the program in the second hour, to defend this idea. Now, he readily acknowledges that there are a lot of unknowns about it. There have not been adequate test groups on this, on what happens. But all the accusations that people immediately knee-jerk make, that people will no longer work and so forth, at least in small scale test ideas, have not proven to be true. Maybe a decline in labor, but not anything like a complete abandonment of the work ethic. So I think it's worth hearing him out anyway, and certainly the idea, and you're certainly welcome to call with your questions or thoughts anytime during the program. And I'll post a link to the article. It's already on the show blog. If you go to MikeAllenShow.blogspot.com, you can link the article for yourself. But I'll also put it on the show's Facebook page. Hopefully you can check it out. Andrew Flowers, my guest in the second hour. We'll talk about some other things today as well, of course. Lessons from the Areopagus at Mars Hill, the first reading today. St. Paul and the importance of persuasion. Also, more of what we talked about yesterday on pornography's effect, particularly on the young. And as I said, more on the month of Mary. All that coming up on the program today. Certainly welcome your calls, as I said. Calls or text 573-4BREAD-4. 573-4BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Or you can post any thought or response on Facebook or on Twitter. Mike Allen Show is the handle. Had a great night last night celebrating my son's 16th birthday. Put some steaks on the grill. I got to get a new grill, though. Unfortunately, I tend to buy on the cheap. And I bought a cheap grill, gas grill, a couple of years ago. And it's pretty much already needs to be put on the side of the road, which someone will pick up, by the way. My wife and I usually have a running bet when we put something on the side of the road. No matter how horrible of shape it's in, somebody will be like, hey, free stuff, and they'll pick it up. I understand that mentality because we are that family as well. Now, my wife is worse at it than me, I'll be honest with you. Can't tell you the number of times, you know. It's like the time she showed up with a Nordic track somebody had left on the side of the road. And we were all excited. This was going to be our ticket to aerobic health. Lasted for about a week, and then it became a clothes hanger. Pretty soon, we had it on the side of the road, and somebody else picked it up. So, you know, it's just a way of spreading the love. Anyway, I need a new grill, because only half of my grill right now, only half of it is working. So I was trying to bunch, you know, you got a big family, 8 people at home right now, steaks on the grill. And we're not talking filet mignon, by the way, or even ribeye. But anyway, that manager's special. That's what I'm always looking for. But filled up half the grill, so I got to work on that. But had a nice night. Thanks for asking. All right, let's look at the reading for today, the first reading, which is taken from the book of Acts, chapter 17, all during this Easter season, which time is running out on the Easter season. We've got Ascension Sunday coming up this Sunday. And, Ascension's really on Thursday, but it's abrogated to a Sunday. And then we'll have Pentecost the week after that. So the 50 days of the Easter season reaching their climax with the gift of the Holy Spirit poured out upon the apostles at Pentecost. But we remain during the Easter season during the readings, oftentimes the first reading, taken not from the Old Testament as per usual throughout the liturgical year, but taken from the book of Acts of the Apostles. And a shift has now happened in our readings, and we're beginning to see more and more of the ministry of St. Paul, also known as Saul, who had his dramatic conversion on the road to Damascus, and the apostles who are fulfilling Jesus' own commission and promise that when the power of the Spirit came upon them, that they would become witnesses in concentric radiating circles, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And so today's passage finds Paul in Athens, Acts chapter 17, a place of great religious fervor, right? Pagan religious fervor, nonetheless, but certainly religious fervor. What I find fascinating about this, the more I read of St. Paul's experience there in Athens, and you won't get this in the sort of selected verses that are part of the reading. You got to read the whole section in Acts chapter 17, beginning about halfway through the chapter. It says, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he grew exasperated at the sight of the city full of idols. Now you can imagine St. Paul, this fierce monotheistic Jew, in another country, in another culture, and he sees this devotion to a whole panoply of different gods. Had to fly against the monotheism in him like nobody's business. And St. Paul, who was not exactly a wallflower, type A personality, always ready to contend for the faith, ready to do just that. And we're going to look at this when we get into the second hour, because something happens. Paul calms down, I guess you could say. As it says here, when Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he grew exasperated at the sight of the city full of idols. So he debated in the synagogue with the Jews and with the worshipers, and daily in the public square with whoever happened to be there. So here St. Paul was. He was contending. He was exasperated at the sight of the city full of idols. They take him out to the Areopagus, or Mars Hill, the place which was sort of the public square area where ideas were exchanged. And they asked him to speak. This would be the opportunity St. Paul would have to lambast their idolatry and their many gods. But Paul takes a different tack. Maybe a prompting of the Spirit, but understands his role not so much in this setting to confront as to persuade. And we'll talk about that in the second hour. We'll be back with our question of the day. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show on this Wednesday, May 4th. That's right. It is Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. It's amazing how that horrible pun has gotten such traction. Anyway, but it gives me an excuse to do my Chewbacca imitation. That's about as good as I can do. Or my Yoda, you know. Choo-choo, I will. Everybody can have fun with their various impressions. 5734BREAD4. The best thing I've seen on Star Wars, though, I got a couple kids who are obsessed with this, is a couple of these bad lip-reading versions of Star Wars, if you've seen these. You just go to YouTube, which YouTube, in my opinion, I know there's a lot of bad on the internet, okay? Believe me. You give the devil... This is why the devil can't have nice things, okay? He ruins them all. But YouTube, to me, one of the great gifts of the modern world. So just go Google up bad lip reading Star Wars. I mean, they've taken on the NFL, bad lip reading presidential debates, and some of these musical numbers. They've got some of the different Star Wars characters singing. Priceless. So check it out. Anyway, so my question of the day today, on this day back in 1970 on May 4th, horrible, horrible event in the American experience, and that is the Kent State shootings there at Kent State University in Kent, Ohio, which involved the shooting of unarmed college students by the Ohio National Guard. It was a Monday. They had gathered for several days protesting the Cambodian campaign of the Vietnam War. And I was reading a little bit about this last night. Didn't know that the guardsmen there fired 67 rounds over a period of 13 seconds, killing 4 students, wounding 9 others, one of them suffering permanent paralysis. It was just a huge and terrible event, and it's been captured, immortalized, really, with the Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph of John Philo, of Mary Ann Vecchio, a 14-year-old runaway who was kneeling over the body of Jeffrey Miller minutes after he was shot by the Ohio National Guard. You've, I'm sure, seen the shot, and I've posted it on the show's Facebook page along with the question of the day. And question of the day is, what do you think has been the most powerful photograph in American history? And, you know, the photograph has a particular power to really sum up something. And I think this photo has got to be one of the greatest, in my opinion. I mean, it's a tragic, it's a horrible photo, of course, of this, of the anguish of this young girl kneeling over this slain student. But you talk about a photo that really captures the essence of what the mood must have been like there at Kent State. You look at, you know, there are other, of course, significant photos. You think about the young migrant mother with that weathered look on her face, or you think about the photo of raising the flag at Iwo Jima. There are lots of others. But I'm going to even give you the opportunity, if you want to go on to either Twitter, or if you want to go on the show's Facebook page, Mike Allen Show, and post which photo that you would vote for as the most powerful photo in American history, you're welcome to do that. Or you want to talk about it. 573-4-BREAD-4. Maybe you remember the Kent State shooting. I was four at the time. But if you remember it, give us a call. 573-4-BREAD-4. You can call or text, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Yeah, there's something about the power of the photo. And I, you know, especially when photos were not as ubiquitous as they are now. Some of the images, of course, I came across an article online that listed, I think, the something like the 50 most important. Is that right? Of the 50 most important photos in United States history. So you got like a picture of the Little Rock Nine as they are integrating the schools there and being shouted at by some of the white students that are there. You got Rosa Parks' arrest photo. Of course, the kiss at the end of World War II in Times Square between the sailor and the nurse there at VJ Day. You've got allies invading Normandy. You've got the Hindenburg disaster and the flight at Kitty Hawk. So there's some really good ones there. I can't believe they don't have this Kent State photo on their top 25, though. Just saying. Checking out sports news, of course, last night, Golden State serving notice that even with Steph Curry hobbled and not playing, they're a force to be reckoned with, the force to be reckoned with. Went into the fourth quarter down 11 to the Portland Trail Blazers and finished winning by 11. So a 22-point swing all in the space of the fourth quarter. And now it's looking like probably Steph Curry's going to be back. So Portland facing a do-or-die game in Game 3 as they return home to Portland. So a very impressive victory for the Warriors, no doubt. Another interesting piece that I saw on ESPN.com was the could have beens. They listed what are the top 25 instances, they say, of unfulfilled potential for athletes. And players that, for whatever reason, either because they squandered their talent or because they were slowed or stopped by injury, it left all of us wanting more. And so you have some of the usual suspects on here. You know, you have Bo Jackson coming in at number 24. Bo Jackson, of course, through no fault of his own, a freak hip injury playing for the Oakland Raiders or the L.A. Raiders at the time, I guess, in what seemed to be a routine tackle by the Cincinnati Bengals. Never was able to recover, had to have a hip replacement, all the rest. You go Tony Conigliaro for the Boston Red Sox, who had such a fantastic early career until he was hit by a pitch that ended up blurring his vision. You have Lawrence Phillips coming in at number 14. I remember watching Lawrence Phillips play for Nebraska in college, and man, what an athlete. But just had these personal demons. Of course, Lawrence Phillips dying recently, just in prison. Somebody who could not manage his interior demons. Then you go down the list, and unfortunately, there at number two, being a Kentucky basketball fan, is Sam Bowie. Sam Bowie, who it's only fitting that he's number two because he was taken number two in the 1984 NBA draft. and of course, famously taken ahead of Mr. Michael Jordan, 23. Number one was Hakeem Olajuwon. Nobody could really complain about that. But then Bowie taken above Jordan, and of course, has been in many ways a punchline his entire career, because Bowie, who had injuries in college, and those same pattern of injuries carried over in the NBA, the 7'1" Bowie, never was able to really fulfill his potential as the player that people hoped he would be, through no fault of his own. And I was thinking that Sam Bowie's taken a little too much heat for that over the years. I mean, 7'1", multi-skilled player, of course, without the injury concerns, you're going to take him number two. Nobody knew that Jordan was going to be what he became. So anyway, and then number one, Greg Oden, also hampered by injury. So two NBA big men are the top two on that list. All right, let's move on to the What Were You Thinking nominees of the day. We've got a few. You know, I know Donald Trump is riding high today after his big win in Indiana yesterday, effectively forcing Ted Cruz to bow out of the race. But we want to add to his celebration by making him a nominee for the What Were You Thinking Award. Evidently, what, yesterday linked Ted Cruz's father to the Kennedy assassination? Oh, Donald. You got to say this about Donald. He loves a conspiracy, whether it's a birth certificate or whatever. Now he's saying that Rafael Cruz, you know, how Trump does it, though. It's kind of like, look, I have no proof. I'm just saying. Really? The Kennedy assassination? Anyway. How about this? This is our second nominee, I have to say, is the American Family Association. Listen, I understand the concern, the frustration with a store like Target. Certainly, if people who want to boycott Target over their bathroom policy, go for it. I mean, that's, I think, every consumer has a right to make clear their opinions on this. I've said from the beginning, I think these bathroom laws, I mean, in some ways, we were better off in a sort of don't ask, don't tell situation. Those who leapt out there and made these declarations that people go to the bathroom in the gender they identify with, really? But then I think the backlash reaction has been almost just as bad. And now the American Family Association evidently is testing Target's new policy by sending men to women's bathrooms, according to their own director of governmental affairs, Sandy Rios. Really? You're sending people in to test it? People, can we just all calm down? Anyway, that's our second nominee. I'll give you the winner when we come back from the break. You'll really appreciate it, because it is the award's going to go to a fairly universally loathed company, evidently. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show. We're right at the bottom of the hour here on the Mike Allen Show, 30 minutes after, 30 minutes before on this Wednesday, May 4th, and my pleasure to be with you. Again, my question of the day here on the anniversary, the 46th anniversary of the tragic shooting at Kent State University, in which four unarmed students were killed by National Guardsmen and nine others were wounded, and was captured in a Pulitzer Prize winning photograph with the Marianne Vecchio leaning over one of the slain students and her anguished cry immortalized forever in the photograph. My question is, what do you think is the most powerful photograph in American history? And if you want to post your response to this question, you can do so on the show's Facebook page. Just look up Mike Allen Show is the handle. You'll find it there. You could tweet it as well. Mike Allen Show, the handle. We've already had, let's see, I think Shannon was one who posted her own response to this, and I believe, so if I can pull it up here, it was the self-immolation of the Vietnamese Buddhist right around the time of the Vietnam War, or in the years leading up to the Vietnam War, if you've ever seen that photo. Oh, unbelievable. The guy, the Buddhist who was sitting there seemingly in complete serenity, gas can just a few feet to his right, and he is engulfed in flames there in his Buddhist monk robes, surrounded by a bunch of other Buddhists. He was doing it in protest to what he saw were unjust policies from the Vietnamese government. Certainly that image really transfixed the world's attention. So what do you think is the most powerful one? 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to talk about it. Or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Love to hear from you. Back to our What Were You Thinking nominee of the day. We've had two nominees. As I said, one Donald Trump for accusing Rafael Cruz of being maybe the, I guess he was in the grassy knoll. Conspiring in the Kennedy. And this, I know the American Family Association, and they've done some good over the years. I mean, there's nothing wrong in free society to make your voice heard and to collectively use your own spending power to bring to heel companies that are rejecting or are promoting values and ideals that you find to be profoundly offensive. We're not talking about censorship. We're talking about the power of the collective of people saying, look, we're not going to support you if you do this, and that's totally fair game. So I have no problem with the American Family Association generally. But this idea that they are sending people into the Target restrooms to prove that there's no barriers to, I guess, intergender bathroom association. I don't know. I just think it's misguided. But our winner, we're going to give to the cable giant Comcast. As the consumerist.com puts it, if there's one lesson that large corporations really, really need to take to heart about the 21st century, it is this. Unless you are universally beloved, and maybe even then, probably don't self-promote with Twitter hashtags. It will not end well for you. And who would be the latest business to fall for this trap? It's Comcast, the cable company America loves to hate. Like many other corporations and conglomerates, Comcast participates in corporate philanthropy, and among their outreach efforts is an annual volunteer day where Comcast and NBC Universal employees don branded T-shirts and go serve meals, clean playgrounds, paint schools, and do 1,000 other small good works projects. This is not uncommon. Corporate volunteer events happen all the time, and usually a good way to promote some or to generate some positive PR of sorts. And of course, how else to quickly push images, videos, and short statements but on social media? And naturally, organizers want to unify the social media presence with a hashtag, something quick and easily searchable, like hashtag Comcast Cares Day. But this is where the What Were You Thinking award comes in. As the consumers.com says, the problem is that Comcast is not exactly known for caring as such. Kind of the complete opposite, really. Their customer service is widely loathed, despite repeated executive promises and detailed improvement plans. Evidently, Reddit co-founder Alexis Ohanian landed the most direct punch, tweeting, maybe Comcast should extend hashtag Comcast Cares Day so they actually care the other 364 days of the year. I had this experience with a major company the other day, by the way, trying to call their customer service line, and the myriad of punch this number and this pound sign and all this stuff and estimated wait times and all the rest. No thank you. Anyway, some other tweets. Show someone you care. Bill them for the 3 weeks their cable was out due to a hurricane. Hashtag Comcast Cares Day. Claire, some woman named Claire tweets, in honor of hashtag Comcast Cares Day, I'm also going to put everyone who calls me on hold for 20 minutes and then eventually hang up. So our winner is going to be Comcast for their decision to go with Comcast Cares Day. Be careful what you do, companies. Listen, if you have a nominee in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you want to nominate yourself, believe me, we've all paid the stupid tax from time to time. 573-4BREAD-4. You can call me or text that number, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. My friend Jason Hall, as you know, who is kind of my favorite political analyst, he is the executive director of the Catholic Conference of Kentucky. Try to have him on about once a month. Well, of course, Jason's getting married in less than 3 weeks to the beautiful Jessica McFarland, and longtime friends, and finally going to be united in matrimony, beautiful church in Kentucky. And but Jason begged off being on the show this week, which is his typical week, because he's a little bit got some details to work out for the wedding. But as such, not able to get his commentary on what went down in Indiana yesterday with, as it seemed like polls had been predicting, Donald Trump with a big win. Of course, Bernie Sanders also with a win. I haven't read as much in terms of the significance of that, but the significance of Donald Trump's 20-point win, I think, or 15-point win, not sure what the final poll said or the final results said of his win there in Indiana. Actually, let's see. I'm not seeing it overall. Indiana Trump, 53.3. Cruz 36.6, Kasich 7.6. It actually prompted Ted Cruz to withdraw from the race, or at least to suspend his campaign. Now it looks pretty apparent that Donald Trump is going to get the Republican nomination before the convention, unless some unexpected development occurs. Really surprised Kasich's terrible showing. Of course, I know he and Cruz had some sort of a deal that many of the voters evidently did not appreciate. But Jason was not able to be here, but I'm going to then cheat by reading something he posted on his own Facebook page, because I think it says it's a pretty good word. He says, I know representative democracy is the best form of government, and he has best in quotes here, but that's only because it's the least bad. Not because there's anything particularly good about it. And in times like this, that becomes crystal clear. There's nothing inherently good about majority opinion, and often a great deal wrong with it. Saying the people have spoken is not an argument for anything. Democracy is often the form of government that shouts, give us Barabbas. I've heard that one before, right? If you recall that whole scene where Pilate was going to give the people the choice, they could release one prisoner because of the Passover. And the choice was between Jesus of Nazareth and Barabbas. And the people chose Barabbas, which, again, for those of us who love democracy, it's a nice check of realism on the fact of what democracy can be. And evidently, we're going to probably end up with two major party candidates in this election this fall, who are both deeply, deeply flawed candidates. And yet I guess it's been said we get the candidates we deserve. I mean, these are the people that we will have voted in, and they will be set up to run against each other. It's pretty staggering, and I'll be honest with you, a little bit depressing. Anyway, let's move on to what happened in history on this day throughout the years, May 4th, over the ages.
Where are we, dude?
These are the circuits of history, gentlemen. They'll take us to any point in time we wish.
Where are we?
Gentlemen, we're history.
So we already said on this day in 1970, the Ohio National Guardsmen opened fire on the anti-war protesters at Kent State University. Of course, I wasn't there, and I'm sure things are always more complicated than they seem, but hard for me to imagine there couldn't have been a better outcome in that situation. In 1415, not one of the better moments, I don't think, in Catholic history, religious reformers John Wycliffe and Jan Hus condemned as heretics at the Council of Constance. Of course, they would both be executed. In 86, the Haymarket Affair, a bomb thrown at policemen trying to break up a labor rally, killing 8 and wounding 60. Just goes to show you that our century does not have the market on terroristic violence. Audrey Hepburn's birthday today. She would be 87. Of course, died very young at the age of 64. 1932, Al Capone began serving an 11-year sentence. We'll be back on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. Don't know much biology.
You can reach me by railway. You can reach me by trainway. You can reach me on an airplane. You can reach me with your mind. You can reach me by caravan. Cross the desert like an airy man. I don't care how you get here, just get here if you can. You can reach me by sailboat, climb a train, swing rope to rope, take a sled and slide down slow into these arms of mine. You can jump on a speedy coast.
14 minutes before the hour.
Cross the border in a blaze.
Smooth vocal sounds of Olita Adams today, whose birthday. She's 54 years old today. I don't really know any other Olita Adams songs. I don't really have to. I mean, her whole career to me has been worth it for just that song. Get Here. I love it. 573-4BREAD-4 if you've got a comment or a question, 573-4BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. My question of the day again here on the 46th anniversary of the Kent State shooting, forever captured in a Pulitzer Prize winning photograph of the 14-year-old Mary Ann Vecchio leaning over the slain student. What do you think has been the most powerful photograph in American history? That one, I think, just captures the essence of that moment and the of how things went so wrong so fast in a time of great internal national turmoil. Again, my guest next hour will be Andrew Flowers. Andrew, who writes for the website 538.com. Most of the other stuff that I've read he's written has been in the realm of sports, but he ventures over into economics and asks the question, what would happen if we just gave people money? It's an article about a concept called universal basic income. That is a proposal that has been around for a while. It's gaining steam again in some areas of the world, in which the idea is that you sort of eliminate the myriad of bureaucratic agencies and all the rest for the social safety net, and you just give people straight cash, a guaranteed income. And, of course, the immediate protests that come with that Flowers, who I think is an advocate for the further study of this idea, takes on some of those things, some of those objections, and talks about it. And I'm particularly fascinated by how he sees it as an answer to this trend toward automation that we have in our society and our economic system today, that are going to be eliminating a lot of jobs. And this is perhaps a way to help overcome some of the insecurity that a lot of people feel and experience. 573-4BREAD-4, if you've got a comment on that, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, for sure. Yesterday, we talked some about the impact of pornography and social media on the young, particularly young girls, and how they are affected by the way that by how boys are affected in many ways by pornography. And this increasing understanding of pornography as a public health crisis and the way that it affects so much of how we integrate and interact with the, with our sexuality and with each other in the culture. Bishop Paul Laverde of the Diocese of Arlington, who I think has been sort of the point person for the U.S. bishops on this, with a with an article in the most recent or on the blog First Things, the blog associated with the Journal of Religion and Public Life. Bishop Laverde says, confronting the public health crisis of pornography. He said, something is afoot. Porn and the threat to virility recently hit the stands, not in the form of a religious tractate, but on the cover of Time. Just prior to that, Bishop Laverde says, in The Joy of Love, Pope Francis decried the flood of pornography and its pernicious spread, which deforms sexuality. If you missed both Time and Pope Francis, then perhaps you heard the news last week from Utah, where they declared pornography as a state, as a public health crisis. Bishop Laverde says, I hope we've reached a turning point in the public debate on pornography. So too, I pray that you and I enter this debate with new resolve. The science is on our side, to say nothing of our understanding of human dignity and sexuality. He says, if we stand back, I fear we will be complicit in handing further victories to pornographers and sex traffickers and those who would rather make our children guinea pigs in a lucrative $95 billion a year industry. He republished a pastoral letter from 2006 and 2014 called Bought with a Price, Every Man's Duty to Protect Himself and His Family from a Pornographic Culture. He says, in his role as bishop, I've come to understand just how great and increasing a plague pornography is on families, individuals, the church, and indeed our entire culture. As he says, pastoral exhortations cannot, in the stroke of a pen, affect a policy change. But by defining pornography as a public health crisis, he says the people of Utah, for example, have taken a stand as a vanguard in this fight to protect our human dignity. See, this is where we really have to help folks understand what we're talking about here, because we're not talking about discomfort at naked people. That's kind of oftentimes the way it's seen, as some sort of a Puritan, you know, rejection of sexuality and the body, this prudish idea that sex is dirty. No, we're talking about the dehumanizing power of pornography in terms of the person and how it reduces a person by its very nature and how it warps and distorts one's understanding of sexuality. You know, of all the ways that we as Christian believers get accused all the time of being hostile to science, this seems to be one of those areas where the tables turn a bit, and those who consider and pride themselves on always being willing to look at the science and at the data, for some reason, when it comes to sexuality, won't do that. These persons will not do that. It's that they would rather go with either their gut instinct or their intuition or simply their own personal agendas and desires. But the truth is, the so-called sexual revolution, which, by the way, didn't just begin in the 60s. It began really with the widespread push toward readily available and acceptable contraceptives in the culture, which began happening in the first few decades of the 1900s, particularly with the eugenics push. And then in 1930, when the Church of England became the first Christian community of any sort to give sort of grudging permission to married couples in extreme circumstances to use contraception. And of course, it didn't take long before many other Christian communities came on board. And before you had it, you had a complete detachment of the sexual union from its original marital meaning, to where it became really an exchange of pleasure between people who consent. And that's the place we've come to now, where there virtually is no. And we talked about this either last week or the week before, on the sense that the honeymoon, the newlywed bed, the marriage night has become a meh kind of thing, because we no longer see the sexual union as the uniting of two persons in a profound commitment of their entire life project together. Sex, by its very nature, becomes sort of a recreational activity. And the problem is that all this recklessness and all this reducing of the sexual act and its meaning has had profound public health consequences and continues to. And now it's deeply and profoundly affecting the young and how they understand their sexuality, how they understand who they are as a human being, what brings them value. We're going to have this woman, Nancy Jo Sales, on the program coming up this Friday to talk about her book, American Girls, that talks about the impact of social media on young people, and particularly in the way young boys view young girls and what they want from girls, but more profoundly on young girls and how they are taught to view themselves and to value themselves primarily as sexually available objects, and how this is having a profound impact, not only in terms of consequences like, for example, unwed pregnancy, which is at an all-time high in this country, which, ironically enough, the pill was supposed to eliminate, rampant cases of sexually transmitted diseases and sexually transmitted infections, to where we have, I think, now 80% of adults in the United States who carry the HPV virus. But we have this profound, this self-loathing among young girls, which manifests itself in this horrible dynamic of cutting, for example, because we set up these images, or young men set up these images, and it can't help but impact the way they view and the way they treat women. And most of us have our collective heads in the sand about this issue. We really do. Thanks to Bishop Paul Laverde for having the courage and for leading his brother bishops in addressing this precisely as what it is, as a public health crisis to which we need to awaken before it's too late. We'll be back with a new hour on the other side of the break, including a conversation with Andrew Flowers of 538.com. This is the Mike Allen Show.